It is Friday, June 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump's immigration actions could shape the results of the upcoming midterm elections. The battle for Hodeidah puts thousands of Yemeni civilians at risk, and the Salvation Army's first grocery store helps the disadvantaged in Baltimore. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump said Friday Republican lawmakers should abandon efforts to pass an immigration bill until after the November midterm elections. He blamed Democrats for their lack of support of a pair of immigration measures. Trump's decision to reverse a policy of separating immigrant families coming across the U.S. southern border came in the wake of a political firestorm this week. It also sets the stage for immigration to be a key issue in the elections. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the political fallout from Washington.
President Trump center stage at a political rally in Minnesota, vowing to make immigration a central issue in this year's congressional election campaign.
If you want to create a humane, lawful system of immigration, then you need to retire the Democrats and elect Republicans to finally secure our borders.
Just hours earlier, the president reversed his controversial policy of separating children from their parents.
So we're going to have strong, very strong borders, but we're going to keep the families together.
Trump backed away from the separation policy after an outcry around the country that included protests, especially after the release of audio of children crying out for their parents. The outrage crossed party lines and included Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings.
We should be able to agree that we will not keep kids in child internment camps indefinitely and hidden away from public view. What country is that? This is the United States of America.
Advocates of a tough border policy, like Art Arthur, sided with the president.
That large influx of individuals would suggest that we are starting to, creep back up the numbers we saw during the Obama administration, and the Trump administration needed to take action to respond. And this is an appropriate response.
But many religious leaders were critical, including Catholic Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
To use the means of separating a child from his or her mother just is completely unacceptable for us as Americans.
The immediate political fallout could hurt the president, says analyst Larry Sabato.
It's a public relations disaster area for the Trump administration, and just about everybody but Donald Trump and his very strongly anti-immigration aides seem to realize that.
But Sabato also says the president's tough stance is aimed at shoring up his political base ahead of the November elections.
Of course, they're focusing on their base. They're trying to make sure that they're going to show up and vote. It could make some difference in close midterm elections.
Trump's poll numbers have improved of late, especially in the wake of the summit with North Korea. But the surveys were taken before the firestorm over separating families at the border. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. President Trump threatens a 20% tariff on cars from the European Union. A radical Indonesian cleric gets the death sentence for terror attacks in 2016. And Russian President Vladimir Putin may meet with U.S. Security Advisor John Bolton next week. That's according to TASS. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. NASA says a thick Martian dust storm that kicked up regionally toward the end of May has grown and spread over much of the Red Planet. The space agency says the storm is now considered to be a global dust event. Soon after the storm began, NASA's Opportunity Mars rover was forced to suspend its science operations. Since the 14-year-old rover is solar-powered, the thick enveloping dust storm has blocked the sun's rays from reaching its solar panels, essentially cutting off its supply of power. So far, the growing dust storm has not affected NASA's younger rover, Curiosity, which is across the planet from Opportunity, since it's nuclear-powered and doesn't depend on the sun for energy. But the roving Curiosity has also been taking photos of the sky getting hazier from the approaching dust storm. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, OPEC agrees to increase oil production. We'll have a report. United Nations aid agencies are ramping up humanitarian operations in Yemen's port city of Hodeidah as fighting between government and rebel forces for control of the port heats up, putting hundreds of thousands of civilian lives at risk. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Conditions have seriously deteriorated since government forces backed by the Saudi-led coalition began the battle to wrest control of the rebel Houthi-held port of Hodeidah 1 week ago. The United Nations considers Yemen the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. It has been trying to broker a truce between the warring parties with no success. A spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says aid agencies are deeply worried about the civilians caught in the middle of this conflict. He notes even before the fighting began, conditions in Hodeidah were some of the worst in the country.
25% of children in Hodeidah are suffering from acute malnutrition. If malnutritional support from humanitarian partners is disrupted, it risks the lives of almost 100,000 children. Hodeidah was also one of the epicenters of last year's cholera outbreak, one of the worst in modern history.
Last year, cholera cases in Yemen topped 1 million in the world's worst outbreak of the disease. A World Health Organization spokesman, Christian Lindemeyer, tells VOA concerns are growing over a possible resurgence of this fatal disease.
Monday, a major water pump was hit, leaving 10,000 households without water supplies and with increased risk to waterborne diseases. So here's a fear that the situation might fuel another wave of cholera.
Lindmeyer says there are plans to vaccinate more than 800,000 people in Hodeidah with oral cholera vaccination. The port of Hodeidah is a vital lifeline for people throughout Yemen. It imports crucial humanitarian relief supplies and is the main entry point for commercial goods, including fuel, food, and medicines. Putting this vital port out of commission would have dire humanitarian consequences. The World Food Program reports so far it has been able to provide food to Yemen on a nonstop basis. This week, it reports it imported enough food for 6 million people for 1 month. WFP spokeswoman Bettina Lucia warns the situation for millions of people would become life-threatening if the port were no longer operational.
We are basically keeping the people of Yemen alive. Without the humanitarians, all of the humanitarian partners, the people of Yemen would die if the humanitarians were not on the ground. So we have been bringing food into Hodeidah, we're channeling it into other areas, and we are always talking with all sides to make sure that humanitarian aid is going in.
Another casualty of the war is the suspension of migrant returns from Yemen. The International Organization for Migration reports it has been forced to postpone its operation to help migrants stranded in Hodeidah return home because of the fighting. Last year, the agency repatriated 2,860 migrants from Yemen, 746 through Hodeida Port. The majority were Ethiopian migrants. Others included migrants from Sri Lanka, India, Nigeria, and Pakistan. So far this year, IOM has assisted more than 430 migrant returns. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Turks go to the polls Sunday in one of modern Turkey's most important national elections, with both parliament and the presidency at stake at the same time, a first in Turkish history under a new constitution. It will also be a verdict on the 15-year-old rule of controversial President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has been given new executive powers. Mr. Erdogan must capture more than 50% of the vote to avoid a July 8th runoff. His ruling Justice and Development Party, AKP, must take also more than 300 seats in the 600-seat parliament to avoid a coalition partnership. Ahmet Zozan is a political science and international affairs professor at Eastern Mediterranean University on Cyprus. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the outcome is crucial because Turkey matters to the world.
It is the second biggest army in NATO, so who rules Turkey really matters. So the test this time is going to be between whether people are happy with a decade and a half long ruled by Erdogan and his Justice and Development Party, or whether the Turks are ready for change. But of course, the election is going to take place under extraordinary law, the state of emergency, which is continuing in the last 2 years after the coup attempt in the summer of 2016. Erdogan's party is holding the upper hand when it comes to the media coverage, because the majority of the Turkish media is mostly very friendly with Erdogan or under the control of people who are supporters of Erdogan. So the opposition is entering into this crucial election in a disadvantaged position.
Will this election turn on the first-time young voters?
I think so, because Turkey is a country with a huge population which is relatively young, so definitely the young voters are very important. We'll see how many of them or what percentage of them will actually go to the polls. The voters' turnout in Turkey has always been much higher.
Do you expect a runoff July 8th?
If the elections are going to take place in a fair and just mode, let's say, that is my expectation. We have several candidates running in the presidential election, especially, not in the parliamentary, but presidential election. The more candidates we have, the more votes will be distributed among them, and it will be very difficult for one candidate to get more than 50% of the votes in the first round.
How important is the outcome of this election to Turkey, its allies, the European Union, the U.S., and Syria?
I think that this is very important because, especially in the last few years, Turkey has been ruled in a way that there is a high polarization in the country between those who support Erdogan for the matter of stability. On the other hand, we have those who believe that this tension and this polarization in Turkey is very dangerous, that we need to reestablish democratic rule again. We have to uphold rule of law and democracy in Turkey and go back to the parliamentary system rather than handing substantive executive powers into the hands of one man.
Ahmet Zosin of Eastern Mediterranean University in Cyprus. The head of Turkey's high election board said the number of Turks voting in other countries rose to a record level of nearly 1.5 million. They voted from June 7th to Tuesday. Domestically, there are more than 56 million eligible voters. Mr. Erdogan is contesting with five other presidential candidates. A network of election monitors will seek to ensure a free, fair, and transparent ballot following allegations of irregularities in last year's constitutional referendum. OPEC ministers agreed Friday to increase oil output, a move that could ease supply fears and lower world prices, but uncertainties remain about the durability of the outcome. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
The agreement theoretically sees OPEC raising crude oil production by 1 million barrels a day, but analysts say the output will be quite a bit less because some member states have production constraints. Saudi Arabian oil minister Khalid Al-Fali confirmed as much to reporters at the Vienna OPEC meeting.
We know not all 24 countries can produce above their targets, and which is the reason the cut has increased from 1.8 to 2.8. So what actual volumes are released into the market is going probably to be less than 1 million, but the nominal figure we're talking about is 1 million barrels.
While the production increase is small compared to OPEC's overall output, the cartel's decision to boost supplies is a first since 2017, when it started withholding oil to prop up faltering prices. But strong oil demand this year has given a big boost to prices, sparking calls by consumers for more output. That sentiment was echoed by U.S. President Donald Trump, who tweeted Friday that he hoped OPEC would increase output substantially. But it's unclear just how effective OPEC's decision will be in lowering prices in the longer term. U.S. investment bank Jefferies Group was reported as saying the supply boost could help offset declining production and exports by Venezuela and Iran, but it also would leave spare supply capacity at its lowest level in decades. Possible Chinese tariffs against U.S. oil imports as part of an escalating trade war is another uncertainty. The OPEC meeting was marked by disagreement, with Iran's minister reportedly storming out of a meeting on Thursday. Iran opposed the output increase, while Russia and Saudi Arabia were for it. But Iran's oil minister, Bijan Zaghani, told reporters the ministers had agreed to a compromise.
We are going to have a compromise with Saudi Arabia and
He said they agreed to manage the market so Iran didn't face difficulties and not to send the wrong signals to the international market. Experts, however, believe the output increase will not benefit Iran because the country is already exporting close to its maximum capacity. And the expected drop in oil prices will actually mean lower Iranian oil revenue. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's Newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports, or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Many disadvantaged neighborhoods and cities across the United States do not have a nearby grocery store, and many people who live in those neighborhoods have to take public transportation to get to the nearest store, which may be several kilometers away. So the Salvation Army opened a grocery store in a low-income neighborhood that doesn't have one in Baltimore, Maryland. As we hear from VOA's Deborah Block, people in the area can walk to the converted warehouse and buy quality food at low cost.
This family is shopping at the Salvation Army DMG grocery store in Baltimore, Maryland. DMG stands for Doing the Most Good, the motto of the worldwide Protestant charity organization, known for its thrift shops and food pantries in the United States. Customer Joanne Weaver is impressed with the selection and the lower-than-average grocery store prices, which helps stretch her food budget.
It's the first time I haven't had to ride more than 4 miles, because I usually go all over the place to the stores.
Catholic priest Samuel Lupico used to serve in a church in this neighborhood. He is impressed with the nutritious food, which he says will help people who usually cannot afford to make healthy meals.
And I love it because it provides an opportunity for people who don't have stores like this to shop in one without paying for transportation to get out.
Major Gene Hogg, Central Maryland commander for the Salvation Army, came up with the idea of a grocery store for people with low incomes to help them prepare healthier food.
Typically, they've been raised to buy frozen chicken and heat it up, or they stop by a McDonald's. But we can encourage them and let them taste what good, cooked, healthy food could be.
Aaron Keating came into the store for the first time.
To see any sort of company moving in that has a charitable mission, I think, is a good thing for the neighborhood. And if that mission is to supply food to people for a cheap price, I'm for it.
Most of the customers receive government food assistance. They can join a loyalty program that gives them something free each month.
Whether it's free chicken or free light bulbs, whatever we have in order to help them stretch their dollars.
The store also offers nutrition guidance, meal planning, and hires people from the neighborhood. They can learn job skills so they can work at other grocery stores. And in keeping with Salvation Army tradition,
hi, how are you doing today?
Store manager Jim Ferre says DMG also takes food to homeless shelters.
150 meals a night. So it's a grocery store, but yet it's also a social service, has a social service aspect of it.
But despite the similarities with other grocery stores, DMG has one big difference.
Our business model is really to break even, right? If we do better than that, then the proceeds from this will go to support our program called Catherine's Cottage for women who've been rescued from human trafficking.
If the experiment works, Hogue hopes more Salvation Army grocery stores will be opened in disadvantaged neighborhoods in the United States. Deborah Block, VOA News, Baltimore.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has called on the Russian government to immediately release all political and religious prisoners. In a written statement, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said the United States is deeply concerned over the growing number of individuals, now more than 150, identified by credible human rights organizations as political and religious prisoners held by the government of the Russian Federation. Ms. Nauert voiced particular concern over the welfare of four Ukrainians unjustly imprisoned who are currently on hunger strike. All four had expressed opposition to Russia's purported annexation of Crimea or had otherwise supported Ukrainian identity or sovereignty. The four Ukrainian prisoners are filmmaker Oleh Sentsov, serving a 20-year sentence in a remote penal colony above the Arctic Circle, Stanislav Klik, also sentenced to 20 years in prison and who suffers from serious mental health problems after allegedly being subjected to severe torture, Oleksandr Shumkov, one of several imprisoned Ukrainians apparently abducted by Russia or lured into traveling there on false pretenses, and Volodymyr Baluk, who was imprisoned in retaliation for flying the Ukrainian flag in Russian-occupied Crimea. In addition, spokesperson Nauert said the United States is troubled by the case of Oyub Titiev, a human rights activist prosecuted on trumped-up drug charges in Chechnya, whose pretrial detention was recently extended. Ms. Nauert also deplored the detention of religious prisoners in Russia, including Jehovah's Witness Dennis Christensen, who is one of 20 Jehovah's Witnesses detained by Russian authorities since May 2017 in retaliation for their peaceful religious practice, five Church of Scientology leaders subjected to detention without trial since June 2017, and more than a dozen Muslim followers of Turkish theologian Said Nursi. We call on Russia to release all those identified as political or religious prisoners immediately and cease its use of the legal system to suppress dissent and peaceful religious practice, State Department spokesperson Nauert said. The Russian people, like people everywhere, deserve equal treatment under the law and the ability to exercise their rights without fear of retribution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.